always will. Oh, you beg me to keep you in that house on the hill, looking out for love, big, big love.
Live from the Gateway to the West, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Well, by now most of you have seen The Day After Tomorrow, based on Whitley and Art's book, The Coming Global Superstorm. Well, how about nanotechnology? How can that help us prepare and adapt to some of those climate changes that you saw in the movie? And all kinds of things are changing us right now. Human tissue being printed from an inkjet printer? Is that possible? What about microscopic computers that are being implanted in the eye, connected to the brain to restore sight? In a moment, our guest Douglas Mulhall on Coast to Coast AM. Now, Douglas Mulhall is a leading nanotechnology journalist and award-winning documentary filmmaker and broadcast executive. Douglas has also led at least one other life as a pioneer in scientific research. His landmark book, Our Molecular Future, describes powerful new tools to save the globalized economy from nature's time bombs, as he calls it. That cutting-edge approach is reaffirmed with a new co-authored book called The Calcium Bomb, about a nanobacteria linked to heart disease and cancer that is shaking the medical world. It describes the discovery and treatment of a previously undetectable infection in arthritis, heart disease, and other widespread illnesses. We're going to talk with him about that too tonight. The link between these two books is the use of radical nanotechnologies to help us survive nature's wrath at the mega scale from earthquakes and climate changes, and at the nanoscale from new infections. It's everywhere. Our guest tonight on Coast to Coast, Douglas Mulhall. Hi, Douglas. You're keeping busy, I see.
Good to be on the show again.
My pleasure. You're last on with me September 28th, about a year ago almost.
That's absolutely correct.
In that time period, technology continues to move along, Douglas, at just a tremendous clip, doesn't it?
Well, it's funny you should say that, because I just attended a session at the National Academies of Sciences in Washington. And the scientists who are making presentations there, I have to tell you, are just saying, look, this stuff is coming really quickly, and we really have to prepare for it. So you're absolutely correct. It's moving along a lot faster than we think. And there's a very basic reason for that, and it's actually quite simple. What is happening is that nanotechnology is driving the convergence of other technologies, such as what I call the grain technologies, genetics, robotics, artificial intelligence, and nanotechnology. And it is, in fact, that convergence of technologies which is accelerating everything so quickly.
Now, when you say we have to prepare for it, are you talking about industry or people in general?
I think both. Industry actually is running with the ball. If you go on to the site of any of these magazines, such as Small Times, for example, that covers the nanotechnology realm, you'll see almost hourly announcements from companies that they're using yet another new nanomaterial to do another surprising thing. What that is not translating into yet is government agencies being able to glop onto that and say, oh, well, here's how we actually might be able to use this for the public benefit.
Douglas, let's talk a little bit about how we can really dive into nanotechnology to, I think, in the long run, save us. We talk a little bit about Art Bell's book, The Coming Global Superstorm, of which the movie is based from, The Day After Tomorrow. Tremendous climate change. I mean, how can nanotechnology help us there?
Well, the first thing is in detection. And I have to emphasize here that there's been a lot of criticism of the movie by climate scientists who say, well, you know, this is really exaggerated and there's no proof that this type of thing could happen. And while changes over hours or days might seem exaggerated, I have to be absolutely clear that there is some very convincing proof out there that sudden climate changes have occurred over a period of a few years, which our society would find extraordinarily difficult to adapt to. And I can just give you a couple of examples of what has happened and also why it has happened. The first one is not that long ago in terms of historical time, and that is in the year 536 AD, approximately, there were 2 years without summer. And these 2 years without summer resulted in mass starvation around the world, the development of epidemic disease, and actually the fall of a number of government hierarchies around the world, in Europe, in China. It really occurred throughout the Northern Hemisphere. Now, alongside this, there is concrete scientific evidence that some event occurred that threw an enormous amount of dust into the sky. And it is not known whether this was an asteroid impact or a volcanic explosion. But the evidence is there, and the evidence is there in two interesting places. The first one is in ice core samples that show these a thin layer of dust that occurred during these periods. But the other one that is yet more compelling is in the study of tree rings. And that study is known as dendrology.
And it's a very accurate study, too, isn't it, Douglas?
It is. You're absolutely correct. And it's unfortunate that we've been cutting down all these four thousand-year trees, because if we weren't cutting them down so quickly, we might have a better record around the world. But nonetheless, despite that, we have managed to preserve a few of these very long-lived trees, and we found them, actually, in the beams of houses. And that is one place that has provided a very valuable historical record to us. And what has been found is that in this time period, the growth of trees was close to zero. They just basically shut down. So this suggests that the climate was extremely disturbed in the Northern Hemisphere. Now, that's just one example, and it's strange that you never really hear very much about this, despite the fact that several books have been written about it. So within this time period of contemporary civilization, there is no doubt that a significant climate event has occurred which had major impacts on how we developed. Now, if you look back further in time, there is another event that occurred approximately 10,000 years ago. It's called, actually, the early Dryas event. And this is shown in a book by Dr. Richard Alley, who went to Greenland and drilled 2-mile deep ice cores and got a record that basically goes back hundreds of thousands of years to show what actually happened with the climate. And what Alley came up with really stunned everybody, and that was to show that climate changes to the degree where, for example, temperatures in Greenland changed by 15 degrees Fahrenheit on average occurred within the period of a decade. Now, can you imagine in the United States if suddenly our average temperatures changed by 15 degrees Fahrenheit? That would mean swings of anywhere between 30 and 40 degrees from what they are today. Imagine the impact on our economy.
Yes.
Now, coming back to your question about how can we use nanotechnology to protect ourselves from this, the first area that we can definitely get into is detection, is to actually find out how this might be occurring. And actually, the convergence of these technologies that I spoke about earlier is actually occurring now and has been used to detect a possible major cause of sudden climate change. And that major cause is something known as methane hydrate.
Methane hydrate, of course, is something that can be developed either by man because of his use of fossil fuels Is that possible?
Yes, and then in the man-made form, it has to be cooled down because methane hydrate is actually a solid, and it has some interesting properties. It is found throughout the world, just a few meters below the surface of the ocean. Sometimes at great depths, but sometimes at very shallow depths, for example, off the continental shelf. And what happens with methane hydrate is that as soon as it is exposed to a slightly warmer temperature, it expands a thousandfold. And this can cause, first of all, a very violent reaction. And it has been theorized, for example, that offshore landslides have been responsible for releasing methane hydrate bubbles that have caused a lot of these ships to disappear in the Bermuda Triangle. That's a bit of a digression from what we're talking about tonight.
But you're right. That is, as a matter of fact, I was talking about that today with somebody who asked me about the Bermuda Triangle. There was a reporter interviewing me for a column on Coast to Coast, and I told him, I said, that is a possibility, though a lot of us like to believe the possibility of the supernatural. The fact that methane gas bubbles are pulling these ships down, is very, very possible.
Well, yes, and, you know, the supernatural, the apparently supernatural is suddenly becoming real because these methane hydrate bubbles have been observed coming to the surface in many parts of the Caribbean, and off the shore of, off the Atlantic shore. And basically what happens is because you have this tremendous expansion, when it comes to the surface absolutely loses its ability to support anything. So if you have a ship going by and it runs into one of these enormous methane hydrate bubbles, it'll just sink without any warning whatsoever. Now, having said that, it is also a rare occurrence because it usually has to be triggered by something such as an undersea landslide, so it's not something that happens every day. However, in relationship to potential climate change, here's the issue, and here's how nanotechnology and technology convergence are helping us to detect this. Scientists have been able to use these technologies to go down to the ocean floor and actually photograph and see these enormous methane hydrate deposits coming to the surface at the point where there are earthquake faults. And one of them is off the west coast of the United States, where there's the Juan de Fuca Fault, that just runs off of Seattle and Vancouver Island, of course. And what has been found there is an enormous deposit of solid methane hydrate right near the surface, and it is under tremendous pressure because it's at quite some depth.
That may be the biggest on the planet, I believe, that area.
You're correct. The biggest known on the planet. The question is, how many more are out there? It's known for a fact that there are hundreds and hundreds of different methane hydrate deposits around the world. And the trick is for us to actually get out there and find these things. There is so much methane hydrate. There is literally hundreds of more times methane hydrate locked at the bottom of the ocean than is currently in the atmosphere today. So imagine, just think for a moment, if a massive earthquake were to unleash thousands of tons of solid methane hydrate that then expanded a thousandfold and released itself catastrophically into the atmosphere. And it has been theorized, not by some pseudo-science person, but by the National Geological Survey in the United States, that such catastrophic releases caused by undersea landslides and earthquakes could indeed have affected sudden and major climate changes in the past. And this is an extremely understudied area. But certainly when you consider the vast potential for methane to be suddenly increased dramatically in the atmosphere, you have that potential.
But if we have the kind of nanotechnology, Douglas, to, as you say, warn us or give us a head start notice that something's going on, at this point, though, is there anything we can do as a nation, as a world, to fix it? I mean, you can't plug it up.
That's an excellent question. And you know something? You're one of the few people that's asking it. And I think that, and by the way, your program is to be congratulated for doing that, because here we have this enormous discussion going on around America and around the world about the day after tomorrow and whether such things could happen. how many of those discussions are talking about how we can use the billions and billions of dollars a year that are now being invested in nanotechnology to protect American society from these types of things? The fundamental issue here is that the discussion has not begun. And that's why I wrote the book, Our Molecular Future, was to take the detection of these newly discovered environmental phenomena combined with the convergence of these dramatic technologies and put it together and put the question out there. Why don't we use these technologies to begin to detect and protect ourselves against these? And we can get into that in a moment as to exactly how we can do that.
Because here's an example. If they had this technology 536 AD when the summers were gone for 2 years, they might have been able to prepare. They might have been able to store more food, for example, to get them through this period.
Well, not just store food, but imagine, for example, vast solar greenhouses that don't have the problems that we have with greenhouses today, and that is that they're very energy intensive. A lot of people complain about them around the United States because there's a glare from the sun shining off the panels, and you have these problems associated with them. But imagine if you could eliminate those problems, and I can just give you an example. There are transparent materials for greenhouses being developed today that absolutely have no glare whatsoever. So imagine if you could have these and have very low energy required to grow plants, and then you had a sudden climate change. If you were able to build these things, you could actually feed the population for throughout this entire period, and you could actually continue growing food. So it wouldn't be just it would be a dynamic change. It wouldn't be just a question of being able to know in advance, although that is extremely helpful with new detection technologies, but by being able to adapt our entire agricultural system of production, we would then really be able to match nature's complexity and run along with it instead of fearing it and trying to, you know, as the film depicts, everyone running south to the Mexican border and overpopulating Central America. These scenarios are possible in terms of what might happen, but they are not necessary.
Douglas, as science begins to wake up, and that's what I'm going to call this for a moment, begins to wake up about the use of nanotechnology, what are the real dangers in the next couple of years? We could wake up in the midst of a situation that they had, for example, in 536 AD and say, my God, it's too late already. Possible?
Well, if there were a major asteroid impact, and when I say major asteroid impact, I'm not talking about anything that you see in the movies these days. I'm talking about a significant impact of, say, 100 to 200 meters wide, which is entirely within the realm of reality.
Yes.
It's happened in the last century. And if that were to occasion a major methane hydrate release by triggering earthquakes in the suboceanic layers, you could indeed see those types of changes start to happen. So we're at risk, and that's one of the things that I point out in the book, is that we don't know what those risks are, George. We just don't have the tools to say, oh, you know, it's going to happen next year or it's going to happen in 10 years. But there's one thing for sure from the historical record. It is going to occur, and we need to prepare for it if we want to avoid this cycle that civilizations have been through over the last few thousand years of going upwards, attaining tremendous advances that we're doing now, and then going straight downhill, usually due to environmental considerations. So that's why we need to start preparing now.
And it could have been a combination, by the way, of a volcano and perhaps an asteroid in 536 AD.
Don't you very think? Well taken. In fact, if you had a large enough impact at the right place, it could possibly trigger that type of joint activity.
Absolutely. When we come back, Douglas, I'd like to talk with you about some of this new technology that's being used to just change all kinds of things for not only us, but the face of this planet. By the way, Doug's website, couple of them, calcify.com or molecularfuture.com, both those websites linked up with his name. on coasttocoastam.com. I'm George Norrie. I'll be back in a moment with our guest tonight, Douglas Mulhall, right here on Coast to Coast AM.
The official website of Coast to Coast AM is www.coasttocoastam.com. Log on now.
The crowd called out for more. The room was humming harder. As the ceiling flew away.
The Gateway to the West. This is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie on Premier Radio Networks.
Well, we're going to continue discussing with Douglas Mulhall the many uses of nanotechnology, a little real science for you tonight. And by the way, just again very briefly, June 18th, that's the last day of the free CD available. Art Bell's interview with the late Father Malachi Martin on exorcisms. You get that when you order the After Dark newsletter. A couple ways to order. Right on the website, coast2to, coasttocoastam.com, and toll-free, right over the phone, 1-888-727-5505. Coast to Coast continues in a moment. By the way, if you want to see the Venus transit and you don't want to worry about looking at the sun, okay, which you should not do anyway, go to the coasttocoastam.com website. Lex has posted a few links for you, and it really is something. It's going on right now. And, of course, those of us in North America won't be able to see this for several more hours, obviously, because you can't see the sun yet. But just take a look at this. You can see Venus with, as a black dot going across the sun, and it's pretty eerie. You know, Douglas, we are living in some incredibly great times right now, in spite of everything that's going on this planet. It's still very exciting to be around here, don't you think?
I'm constantly amazed. We're definitely in a technological renaissance, the likes of which have never been seen before. And although it may be scary to a lot of people, it is taking us into an era that is not only going to change what we do, but what we are.
Next hour, I want to talk about some of these things that you have reported on that has to do with the calcium bomb, because I think one of our things of saving people is so important on this program that if just one person picks up on some new information, it's well worth it. But this hour, let's concentrate on some more of this incredible technology. You say that computing is speeding up by a thousandfold almost instantaneously. What's going on there?
Well, in order to explain that, George, I just thought I might take a little foray into what is nanotechnology so that perhaps your listeners can just get a brief introduction to it, and then they'll understand why this computing is going so quickly.
Okay.
Nanotechnology is basically today pushing things around at the level of 1/1,000,000th of a meter or a nanometer, and that's about a 1/10,000th the thickness of a human hair. So basically what all of this money is going into right now is taking these atom-sized particles and pushing them around and putting them together, basically using chemistry and physics. And the reason why it is bringing about such dramatic changes is because when you rearrange things at that level, their atomic properties change. For example, gold becomes a million times more luminescent at the nanoscale than it appears to be normally. So if you can structure it that way at the nanoscale, imagine what you can do in terms of, for example, being able to track medicines and disease-seeking devices in the human body that depend on being fluorescent so that, for example, medical scanning technology can see them. So it is this remarkable property at the atomic scale that we have gotten our hands on, and if we can do it right, we can really turn it to our advantage. But that is only the beginning. That is only the first step. That's called positional accuracy, being able to push things around at that level. There's then two other steps. The next step is training a nanoscale device to be able to replicate itself, to make copies of itself.
So even at that small a scale, it would be able to do that.
Well, here's the interesting thing. Nature has been doing it for about 500 million years, or actually much longer than that, with something called DNA.
That's true.
DNA is, in fact, natural nanotechnology. And the funny thing is that you don't hear many nanotechnologists say that because they like to think they're inventing something new. But, in fact, what nanotechnologists are trying to do is replicate what DNA does. And that actually brings me to the third level of nanotechnology, and that is called molecular assembly. That is taking these little things that have self-replicated and turning them into machines that can then build other machines. Now that sounds like some sort of fantastic voyage that you just couldn't imagine, but in fact it's exactly what DNA does. What DNA does is it uses its own little software to instruct chemicals to assemble very complex machines that are known as us. So it's not something that is unknown or unusual. It's just that we haven't been able to understand how DNA does it, how these tiny little proteins that they use fold and unfold chemically and use energy very efficiently to do that. So that's all we're trying to do. All we're trying to do is to figure out how nature makes us. And, you know, although it sounds fantastic, we are very close to doing that. We are very close to understanding how DNA works. And once that happens, then the so-called nanotechnology that you see today, which is basically this primitive pushing around of these little pieces, is going to take us into a whole new realm, because suddenly we're going to be able to control machines that can actually replicate themselves and create larger machines. And, of course, what we're going to talk about a little later is the fears that, you know, Michael Crichton's book Prey has brought about relating to those things and all of that. But just let's talk about, as you mentioned, you know, the positive things and what it can do for people. And that brings us to your question about rapid processing in computing. Again, it is not the nanotechnology itself that is only driving this, but it is the convergence of the different technologies together. The robotics, artificially intelligent systems that are allowing us to come to this juncture with computing. And a couple of examples are diamondoid technologies, where artificial diamonds are now being made extremely cheaply by structuring them at the nanoscale.
And this is beyond, let's say, the last ones that I ever heard of were what, the cubic zirconium, that kind of look.
Yeah, this is not cubic zirconium. This is the real thing. This is pure yellow diamond. This is what scares the bejesus out of the De Beers cartel, because no one can tell the difference. In fact, it's so close that they're trying to reach a deal. I think they may have reached a deal with the diamond manufacturers that they're going to label these diamonds to show that they're artificially made, even though you can't tell the difference from the real thing.
You mean a jeweler with his little eyepiece could not tell the difference?
Well, I tell you, there was a major feature on this about a year ago in Wired magazine, And what happened was an American general went over to Russia and got the process from the Russian military, bought the patents, brought it all back to Florida, and this year started manufacturing these things. And the cost is many-fold less than getting these things out of the ground and selling them through a artificially price-controlled cartel.
Well, give me an example. Like, let's say a 2-carat diamond ring goes for $10,000, for lack of a number. What would one be under this arrangement?
Well, I don't want people rushing. You know, people have disappeared for saying less. But
yeah, we know
you
that.
Know, it has the actual manufacturing cost. There are two types of manufacturing. One is being done in Florida, and one is being done on the northeast coast of the U.S. The Florida process really cuts down the cost by about 70%, but the other process is going to cut the cost by 90 to 95%. So you can just imagine the impacts on diamonds as a store of value.
It would be, here, dear, here's your 6-carat diamond, and she'll think you spent a fortune, won't she?
Yeah, and this is no secret. I mean, there have been numerous articles published on it, and, numerous television networks have done features on it, but people have their heads buried in the sand. They think their diamonds are going to have value forever, and that's bad news for them, but it is excellent news for everybody else, because the computing industry could have massive benefits from it, and here's why. Diamonds have a peculiar characteristic, and that is that they can conduct enormous amounts of current with virtually no heat generation. And as you know, the big problem today with computing, as anyone who knows who puts their laptop on their lap, which no one can do anymore because they get so hot, is that silicone chips heat up, and we're reaching the limit at which silicone chips can really operate because of this heat problem.
That's
well,
true.
Diamonds solve that problem, but the difficulty until now is that they've been so expensive, and also it's been difficult to structure them properly. Those problems have just gone away with these manufacturing processes, and once these diamondoid structures are incorporated into computing chips, you will see an ability to multiply computing power 100-fold with less heat generation than today, less cost, and that will enable us to do a whole bunch of things that we cannot do affordably today, including crunching enormous numbers. That, for example, will allow us to do things like modeling the climate. Because right now we have to have rooms full of computers in Japan and Washington to do some of these even basic climate models. So if you incorporate diamondoid processing into that, you can really start to get a realistic picture of what types of climate changes are going to occur. So here you have this nanostructured diamondoid technology going into computing, going into climate change forecasting, and that is the type of benefit that it can provide for us.
And that is available right now?
Yes. Now, I need to qualify it. The chips are not available, except that there is actually another form of optical chip that again uses technology convergence that is operating 1,000 times faster than conventional chips. And it does exist now, and it is being incorporated into computing, and it's being used, for example, crazily enough, for video games. But you know, that's what's going on in the marketplace today, and that's where you're first seeing it used. But imagine if you have optical processing 1,000 times faster than what you have today, what some of the possibilities are. And this is, again, what I keep harping on in the book, and that is, this isn't happening 10 years from now. This is happening right now, today.
What are these synthetic diamonds called, Douglas, or are they even synthetic anymore?
Well, they actually have no special name. There's a company, I believe, called Gemesis in Florida that is manufacturing them. And, yes, they're called synthetic diamonds, but they are not this cubic zirconium that everyone has been referring to for years and years. These are true yellow diamonds.
This is incredible. I mean, and when you talk about yellow diamonds, I mean, does it look yellow, or most people prefer the real crystal clear ones.
Well, actually, the yellow diamonds are considered to be more valuable. And yes, they are yellow. And if you go to Wired Magazine's website and type in diamonds and nanotechnology, this story, very good story that was written about them about a year ago, comes up, and you can see photographs as well of the two processes that are going on to manufacture these.
You would think that the diamond cartel would have bought this guy out and shut him down pretty fast.
Well, it's interesting you should say that, because I think that's what this labeling discussion is all about. And personally, I don't really understand why the things should be labeled, because they can just put them out there. But in any event, that's what's going on, and the big advantage will be, I believe, in computing.
The possibilities, of course, with nanotechnology are endless. I know there was a marvel just a few months ago when they sent out, scientists had a little picture of a nanotech motor. I don't know if you remember seeing that. You probably do. Real tiny little thing that had an ability to click on and off all by itself. I mean, you're right. It's moving along very quickly.
George, that is an excellent example, because some of those motors are based on DNA. DNA is a very regular type of thing. You know what it's going to do. And because of that, it makes a very good switch. And in fact, scientists at Oxford University have invented DNA motors. And the other nice thing about DNA motors is they have built-in energy source, a chemical energy source. And this is something that people forget. They tend to think that nanotechnology is somehow just mechanical. Nanotechnology at its very basis is a marriage between physics and chemistry, rather than being a mechanical process.
I was talking to a friend of mine today. He's a sports director at a station in St. Louis, and he was talking about how one of his best friend's sons had played several years ago a high school football game, and that the next day the kid was watching a football game with his father on the couch, and he died of a heart attack. And not the father, but the kid did. And when I saw your story today and your new book called The Calcium Bomb, I'm saying to myself, how many people are running around with this incredible amounts of bacteria-linked heart disease, Douglas, and they just don't know it?
Well, and the odd thing is, and we'll get into it in the next hour, literally hundreds of millions of people around the world and many tens of millions in the United States have got a condition that is known as calcification. And it's certainly no secret, but doctors don't talk about it because until now they haven't known what causes it.
Are you going to help us for a little cure on something like this? Is there one?
Well, that's the great debate right now, and I think what's going to happen is I'm going to give a very detailed description of that particular issue when we get to it. The good news is we're definitely heading in that direction.
What companies are out there right now dealing in, not that I'm telling you to give us a stock tip here, but who's out there dealing in nanotechnology on a public basis?
Excellent question. And I have to, you're not going to believe this, but I'm actually going to compliment a U.S. government agency. And then I'm going to take on another one. You know, the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, I have to congratulate, for example, Barbara Karn at the EPA for having really taken this nanotechnology bit and run with it. If you go to the EPA website and you type in nanotechnology, they have actually got a list of environmentally related nanotechnologies, but also nanotechnologies that have environmental implications, which is just about everything. And if you go to their website, they give concrete examples of the research that's going on and the companies that are working on it. And, you know, I would say it's a really excellent source. The other excellent source, of course, is Small Times Magazine, who are, their site is available online. And they really give some excellent examples of companies that are moving along. The trouble with nanotechnology is it's kind of like the car industry. You know, people who invested in car stocks mostly lost their money. It was the industry that generated this tremendous economic growth, but it was very difficult to pick a winner, just as it was difficult to pick a Microsoft. So, and even people who invested in the sector had trouble, you know, making a lot of money. So the best thing to do is really to look at products, you know, to look at what this thing could do. And that's why I suggest, for example, going to the EPA site, because they identify products that have the possibility to help with environmental remediation, energy efficiency, and things like that. So I think it's a really good place to start. And getting back to what I said at the top of the show, the disturbing thing is that despite the ability of these technologies to help us right now adapt to, for example, tornadoes that have ripped apart the Midwest in the past few weeks, and hurricanes that are sure enough to rip apart the East Coast of the United States as they do occasionally, all of these things are dealt with by the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Where is nanotechnology on their website? I don't know. I can't find it. Why has the EPA got it and FEMA doesn't? Very good question.
Yeah, sure. Stay with us, Douglas. I got to tell you, I am really bullish on nanotechnology, and I think, you know, if people are looking for growth, that's where it's going to be. You might as well jump in while it's on the ground floor, because pretty soon it won't be. It'll be way up there on floor number 90. I'll be back in a moment with Douglas Mulhall. We're going to talk about the calcium bomb as well. Nanobacteria linked to all kinds of disease. Back in a moment.
Find out more about tonight's guest. Log on to coasttocoastam.com.
That she's a black magic woman. She's trying to